of dice made from the ankle bones of a sheep. Every boy carried a set of 4 such knuckle bones with him, and they could be used to forecast the future, to settle disagreements, or simply as a fun game. In addition, Jamukha and Temujin also played a more vigorous game on the frozen river that was somewhat like curling. Although the secret history does not mention their use of skates, a European visitor in the next century wrote that hunters in the area frequently tied bones onto their feet to be able to race across frozen lakes and rivers, both for sport and in pursuit of animals. These skills later gave the Mongols a great advantage, because, unlike almost every other army, the Mongols easily rode and even fought on frozen rivers and lakes. The frozen rivers that Europeans relied upon as their protection from invasion, such as the Volga and the Danube, became highways for the Mongols, allowing them to ride their horses right up to city walls during the season that found the Europeans least prepared for fighting. Most of Temujin's youth was consumed by the work of helping his family survive. The games Temujin and Jamukha played on the Onon River are the only known frivolities mentioned in any source on the life of the boy who became the great conqueror. The first time that Temujin and Jamukha swore loyalty to one another was when Temujin was about 11 years old. The boys exchanged toys as a symbol of this oath. Jamukha gave Temujin a knuckle bone from a roebuck, and Temujin gave Jamukha one inlaid with a small piece of brass, a rare treasure that must have traveled a long distance. The next year, they exchanged the adult gift of arrowheads. Jamukha took 2 pieces of a calf's horn, and by drilling a hole through them, made a whistling arrowhead for Temujin, who in turn gave Jamukha an elegant arrowhead crafted from cypress. Like hunters had done for generations, Temujin learned early how to use the whistling arrow to communicate secretly through sounds that other people ignored or simply could not decipher. As part of the second oath-swearing ceremony, boys often swallowed a small amount of each other's blood, thereby exchanging a part of their soul. In the case of Jamukha and Temujin, the secret history quotes Jamukha as saying that the two of them spoke to each other words that could not be forgotten, and together they ate the unnamed food that could not be digested. With this oath, 2 boys became andas, a bond that was supposed to be stronger even than that between biological brothers, because andas freely chose their tie. Jamukha was the only anda Temujin had in his life. Jamukha's clan did not return the following winter, and the coming years separated the boys. This bond, forged in childhood, however, would later become a major asset and a major obstacle in Temujin's rise to power. In contrast with the early intimacy shared with Jamukha, at home, Temujin chafed under the sometimes bullying authority of his older half-brother, Begtur, and the sibling rivalry grew more intense as the two approached adolescence. A strict hierarchy normally ruled the family life of Mongol herders then, as it does now. In the face of so many daily dangers from both predators and weather, Mongols developed a system in which children had to obey their parents unquestioningly. In the absence of a father, whether for a few hours or for months, the eldest son assumed that role. The elder brother had the right to control their every action, to assign them any task, and to take from them or give them whatever he pleased. He exercised complete power over them. Begtur was slightly older than Temujin, and gradually after the father was killed, he began to exercise the power prerogatives of the eldest male. In an account known only from the secret history, Temujin's resentment erupted in an episode that initially appears quite trivial. Begtur, it seems, seized a lark that Temujin had shot. Begtur may have taken it for no other reason than to enforce his claim as the head of the family. If so, he would have done well not to have lorded his power over Temujin. Soon thereafter, Temujin and his full brother, Khazar, who was next to him in age, sat together with their two half-brothers, Begtir and Belgate, fishing in the Onon River. Temujin caught a small fish, but the half-brothers snatched it from him. Angered and frustrated, Temujin and Khazar ran to their mother Oilun to tell her what had happened. Instead of taking the side of her own sons, however, she sided with Begtir, telling them they should be worrying about their enemies, the Taichud, who had abandoned them, and not fighting with their older brother. Oilun, siding with Begtir, portended a future that Temujin could not abide. As the eldest son, Begtir not only could command the actions of his younger siblings, but he had wide prerogatives, including rights of sexual access to any widow of his father, aside from his own mother. As a widow not taken in marriage by one of her late husband's brothers, Oilun's most likely partner would be Begtir, since he was her husband's son by another wife. At this moment of tremendous family tension and potential disruption, Oilun angrily reminded her own sons of the story of Alan the Beautiful, the founding ancestress of the Mongols, who bore several more sons after her husband died and left her living with an adopted son. The implication of the story seemed clear. Oilun would accept Begtir as her husband when he became old enough, thereby making him the head of the family in every sense. Temujin, however, decided not to tolerate such a situation with Begtir. After the emotional confrontation with his mother over Begtir, Temujin threw aside the felt covering over the doorway, a highly offensive gesture in Mongol culture, and angrily rushed off, followed by his younger brother Khazar. The two brothers found Begtir sitting silently on a small knoll overlooking the steppe, and approached him cautiously through the grass. Temujin instructed Khazar, who was the best shot in the family, to circle toward the front of the knoll, while he himself climbed up the backside. They crept up on Begtir quietly, as if stalking a resting deer or grazing gazelle. When they came within easy striking distance, each silently placed an arrow in his bow, and then suddenly rose out of the grass with bows drawn. Begtir did not run, or even attempt to defend himself. He would not deign to show fear in front of his younger brothers. Admonishing them, in the same words as their mother had, that their real enemy was the Taichud clan, he is reported to have said, "I am not the lash in your eye, the impediment in your mouth. Without me, you have no companion but your own shadow." He sat cross-legged and still as his two younger brothers continued to approach him. Knowing clearly what fate lay ahead, Begtir still refused to fight. Instead, he made one final request of them, that they spare the life of his younger full brother, Belgate. Maintaining their distance from him, Temujin and Khazar shot their arrows straight into Begtir, Temujin striking him in the back, while Khazar hit him from the front. Rather than approach him and risk contamination from his blood, which was flowing onto the earth, they turned and abandoned him to die alone. The author of The Secret History does not state whether he died quickly or bled to death in a long lingering end. According to Mongol tradition, mere mention of blood or death violates a taboo. But this killing was deemed of such importance to Temujin's life that it was recorded in detail. When Temujin and Khazar returned home, Oilun is said to have read immediately in their faces what they had done and screamed out at Temujin, "Destroyer! Destroyer! You came from my hot womb clutching a clot of blood in your hand." She turned to admonish Khazar, "And you, like a wild dog gnawing its own afterbirth. Her screaming rage at Temujin is vented in one of the longest monologues in the secret history, during which, in repeated insults, she compares her sons to animals, like an attacking panther, like a lion without control, like a monster swallowing its prey alive. At the end, exhausted, she repeated Begtur's earlier warning as though it were a curse. "Now, you have no companion other than your shadow." Already at this young age, Temujin played the game of life, not merely for honor or prestige, but to win. He stalked his brother as if he were hunting an animal, just as he would later prove to have a genius for converting hunting skills into war tactics. By putting Kossar, who was the better shot, in front while he himself took the rear, he also showed his tactical acumen. Like the horse that must be first in every race, Temujin had determined he would lead, not follow. In order to achieve this primacy of place, he proved himself willing to violate custom, defy his mother, and kill whoever blocked his path, even if it was his own family member. While the killing of Begtur freed Temujin from the grip of his half-brother's dominance, he had committed a taboo act that put his family in still greater jeopardy. They would have to immediately flee the area, and did so. According to Mongol tradition, they left Begtur's body to rot in the open, and avoided returning to that spot for as long as any trace of him might remain. Just as both Begtur and Oilun had admonished, Temujin now found himself with no protector or ally, and he would soon be hunted. He was head of a household, but he was also in danger as a renegade. Until this time, Oilun's family had been a band of outcasts, but not criminals. The killing changed all that, and gave anyone who wanted it an excuse to hunt them down. The Taichud considered themselves the aristocratic lineage of the Onon River, and sent a party of warriors to punish Temujin for the killing in their territory, and to forestall what he might do next. With no place to hide on the open steppe, Temujin fled toward the safety of the mountains, but his pursuers still captured him. The Taichud took him back to their main camp, where, in an effort to break his will, they strapped him into a kang, a device something like an ox yoke, which permitted him to walk but immobilized his hands and prevented him from feeding himself or even getting a drink of water unaided. Each day, a different family assumed responsibility for guarding and caring for him. The Taichud band had several households of subordinate lineages, as well as war captives, living with them as their servants, and it was to these servant families that Temujin was turned over as a prisoner. Unlike the Taichud, who treated him with disdain, he found sympathy and comfort among these families when they took him into their gurs at night. Protected from the view of the Taichud leaders, they not only shared food with him, but in one episode, highlighted in the secret history, an old woman gently tended the raw wounds cut into his neck by the kang. The children of the family also persuaded their father to violate his orders by removing the kang at night, to let Temujin rest more peacefully. The story of Temujin's escape from this impossible situation is further testament to his character, which would shape his rise to power. One day, while the Taichud men got drunk, and Temujin had been assigned to the care of a simple-minded and physically weak boy, the captive suddenly swung the kang around violently, struck the boy's head with it, and knocked him out. Rather than face almost certain death by fleeing on foot across the steppe wearing the kang, he hid in a clump of weeds in a nearby river. shortly after a search began. He was quickly spotted by the father of the family that had treated him kindly. Rather than sounding an alarm, the old man told him to flee when darkness fell. After dark, Temujin left the river but did not flee. He slowly made his way to the old man's gur and entered it, much to the horror and danger of the family. But despite the great risk to their own lives, the reluctant hosts removed the kang and burned it. They hid Temujin in a pile of wool during the next day when the Taichud resumed their hunt for him. That night, they sent him on his way and, despite their poverty, cooked a lamb for him and gave him a horse with which he managed to elude his trackers for the long flight back to his mother's distant and isolated camp. For a poor family to risk their lives to help him and to give him such valuable resources, Temujin must have had some special attraction or ability. Meanwhile, this humble family impressed him as well. The Taichud, with whom he shared a close kinship tie, had once put his family out to die and now appeared eager to kill him. This other family, which had no kinship tie to him, proved willing to risk their lives to help him. This episode seems to have instilled in him not only a distrust of higher-ranking people, but also the conviction that some people, even those outside his clan, could indeed be trusted as if they were family. In later life, he would judge others primarily by their actions toward him, and not according to their kinship bonds, a revolutionary concept in steppe society. Mongol traditions and sources acknowledge only this one brief period of capture and enslavement of Temujin, but a contemporary Chinese chronicler wrote that Temujin endured more than 10 years in slavery. He may have been repeatedly enslaved, or this episode may have lasted much longer than the secret history suggests. Some scholars suspect that such a long period of enslavement accounts for the glaring absence of detailed information on his childhood. In later years, the time of enslavement would have been an episode of shame for Genghis Khan, but even more importantly, would have been a tremendous danger to the descendants of the families that had enslaved him. Virtually everyone associated with the slavery episode had good reason to keep silent about that connection, and to make it seem briefer would be in keeping with Mongol sensibilities that would dictate only barely mentioning the bad while emphasizing instead the heroic nature of the escape. In 1178, Temujin turned 16. He had not seen his intended wife, Bort, since his father's death 7 years earlier, but he felt confident enough in the matter to go out to find her again. Accompanied by a surviving half-brother, Belgate, he set off down the Harlin River in search of her family. When they found the gur belonging to Bort's father, Dae Sechen, Temujin was pleased to discover that Bort still waited for him, even though at age 17 or 18, she was now nearly past the age of marriage. Dae Sechen knew of Temujin's troubles with the Taichud clan, but was nevertheless still amenable to the match. Temujin and Belgate set off toward home with Bort. By custom, a new bride brought a gift of clothing to her husband's parents when she came to live with them. For nomads, large gifts are impractical, but high-quality clothing carries high prestige and also serves a valuable practical function. Bort brought a coat of the most prized fur on the steppe, black sable. Under normal circumstances, Temujin would have presented such a gift to his father. But in the absence of a father, he perceived a greater value to which he could put the coat. He decided to use the sable coat to revive an old friendship of his father's, and thereby make an alliance that might offer him and his now growing family some security. The man was Torgil, more commonly known later as Ong Khan, of the Karayid tribe that lived on some of the most luxuriant steppes in central Mongolia between the Orkhon River and the black forest of larch trees along the Tule River. Unlike the scattered lineages and clans of the Mongols, the Karayid constituted a powerful tribal confederacy that embraced a large group of tribes united under a single Khan. The great expanse of the steppe north of the Gobi fell at this time under the rule of three major tribes. The center was controlled by Ong Khan and his Karayid tribe. The west was dominated by the Naiman tribe under their ruler Tayang Khan, and the Tatars occupied the area to the east as vassals of the Jurchid of North China under their ruler Altan Khan. The rulers of the three large tribes made and broke alliances and waged wars with the smaller tribes along their borders in a perpetual effort to enlist them in campaigns against their more important enemies. Thus, Temujin's father Yesuge had no kinship tie with the Karayid, but he had once been the Anda of Ong Khan, and they had fought together against many enemies. The tie between the men had been stronger than merely patron and vassal, because when they were quite young, Yesuge helped Ong Khan become Khan of the Karayid people by overthrowing his uncle, the Gur Khan, or supreme ruler. In addition, they had fought together against the Merkid and were allied at the same time of Temujin's birth, when Yesuge was on the campaign against the Tatars. According to steppe culture, politics were conducted through the idiom of male kinship. To be allies, men had to belong to the same family, and therefore every alliance between men not connected through biology had to be transformed into ceremonial or fictive kinship. Thus, with Temujin's father and the would-be Karayid leader having been ceremonial brothers as Andas, Temujin now sought to be treated as a son to the old man. By giving Ong Khan the wedding gift, Temujin was recognizing him as his father. And if Ong Khan accepted, he would be recognizing Temujin as his son, and therefore entitled to protection. For most steppe men, such forms of ceremonial kinship stood as adjuncts to their real kin relations. But for Temujin, such chosen forms of fictive kinship were already proving more useful than the ties of biological kinship. The Karayid and the Naiman to the west represented not just larger political units, but more developed cultures tied ever so tentatively into the commercial and religious networks of Central Asia via their conversion to Christianity several centuries earlier by missionaries of the Assyrian Church of the East. Without churches or monasteries among the nomads, the tribal branch of Christianity claimed descent from the Apostle Thomas and relied on wandering monks. They practiced their religion in sanctuaries located in gurs and de-emphasized theology and rigidity of belief in favor of a varied reading of the scriptures combined with general medical care. Jesus exercised a strong fascination for the nomads because he healed the sick and survived death. As the only human to triumph over death, Jesus was considered an important and powerful shaman, and the cross was sacred as the symbol of the four directions of the world. As a pastoral people, the steppe tribes felt very comfortable with the pastoral customs and beliefs of the ancient Hebrew tribes, as illustrated in the Bible. Perhaps above all, the Christians ate meat, unlike the vegetarian Buddhists. And in contrast to the abstemious Muslims, the Christians not only enjoyed drinking alcohol, they even prescribed it as a mandatory part of their worship service. After leaving his bride Borta with his mother in their gur, Temujin set out with his brother Kasar and half-brother Belgate to take the coat to the Christian Ong Khan, who eagerly accepted the gift, thereby signifying that he acknowledged each of them as a sort of stepson. The Khan offered to make Temujin a local leader over other young warriors. But in a telling display of his lack of interest in the traditional system, Temujin declined. Instead, he seemed only to want the Khan's protection for his family. And with that assured, he and his brothers returned to their encampment on the Herlin River. There, the young groom sought to enjoy his hard-earned time with his bride and family. The many troubles of Temujin's early years must have seemed behind him and his family, now that everyone was old enough to work in some way. In addition to his brothers, Temujin's household expanded to include two other young men. Borch had joined the group after a chance encounter while Temujin was tracking some stolen horses. Jelm was apparently given to Temujin by his father, although the secret history does not explain why. With these two additions, the camp consisted of 7 teenage boys to hunt and protect the group. In addition to his bride, Borte, Temujin's household also included his sister and 3 older women. His mother Oilun, who was matriarch, as well as Sochigal, the mother of Temujin's half-brother Belgate, and yet another old woman of unknown origin who stayed with them. According to the account of the secret history, Temujin would have preferred to remain simply the ruler of this intimate clan. But the roiling world of tribal attack and counterattack all around them would not allow so idyllic a life. For generations stretching back through hundreds of years, the tribes of the steppes had been preying on one another mercilessly. The memory of past transgressions lingered. An injury inflicted on any family within a tribe served as a license for retribution, and it could serve as a pretext for a raid even after many years. No matter how isolated they might attempt to be, no group such as Temujin's could go unaccounted for or untouched in this world of continual turmoil. After all his family had already suffered, now, after 18 years, the tribe from which Temujin's mother had been abducted, the Merkid, decided to seek their vengeance for that slight. The Merkid came not to reclaim Oilun, the widow who had grown old, struggling to raise her 5 children, but after Borte, Temujin's young bride, who would serve to repay the kidnapping of Oilun from them. The alliance he had so shrewdly made with Ong Khan was to prove decisive in Temujin's response to this crisis, and the challenges of the Merkid would prove the decisive contest that would set him on his path to greatness. Chapter 2. Tale of 3 Rivers. The banner of Chinggis Khan's fortune was raised and they issued forth. Atta Malik Juveni, Genghis Khan, The History of the World Conqueror. Early one morning as the family slept in their gur, which stood alone on an isolated steppe in the upper reaches of the Herlin River, a raiding party of Merkids raced toward them. The old woman the family had taken in lay with her head in the ground, but as old women often do, she passed much of the pre-dawn hours drifting in and out of a fitful sleep. As the horses drew nearer, she sensed the vibrations of their hooves on the ground. Suddenly snapping out of her sleep, she shouted with alarm to rouse the others. The 7 boys sprang up, scrambled frantically to put on their boots, and raced out to their horses, hobbled nearby. Temujin fled with his 6 companions and his mother and sister, leaving behind his new bride, his stepmother Sochigal, and the old woman who had saved them all. In the desperate tribal world, where daily life skirted so close to potential tragedy and annihilation, no one had the luxury of artificially chivalrous codes of behavior. In the quick decision of the utilitarian calculus, leaving these 3 women as booty would at least slow the raiders enough so that the others might have time to escape. For Temujin's fleeing band, the open steppe offered no refuge. They would have to ride hard to reach safety in the mountains to the north. By the time the attackers reached the Gur, Temujin and his small group had raced off into the early morning darkness. But they quickly found Borta hiding in an ox cart that the old woman was leading away. For several desperate days, while the Merkid prowled the vicinity, Temujin stayed constantly on the move, hiding along the slopes and wooded crevices of Mount Burhan Haldun. Finally, the Merkid abandoned their roaming and headed off northwest, toward their home on the distant Selang River, a tributary of Siberia's Lake Baikal. Fearing that the withdrawal might have been a trap to lure him out of hiding, Temujin sent Belgate and their two friends, Borch and Jelm, to track the kidnappers for 3 days, to make sure that they did not double back to surprise him. Hiding in the forest of Mount Burhan Haldun, Temujin faced the pivotal decision of his life, deciding what to do about the kidnapping of his wife. He could have chosen to abandon any hope of recapturing Bort, and that would surely have been the expected course, as his small group could not possibly take on the much more powerful Merkid. In due time, Temujin could find another wife, but he would have to kidnap her, as his father had done to his mother, because no family would voluntarily bestow their daughter on a man who had already lost one wife to more powerful men. In the past, Temujin had relied upon his quick wits to fight or flee. But the decisions had been spontaneous ones in response to a sudden danger or opportunity. Now he had to think carefully and devise a plan of action that would influence the whole of his life. He had to choose his own destiny. In the belief that he had just been saved by the mountain where he was hiding, he turned in prayer to the spirit of the mountain. Unlike the other steppe tribes that had embraced the scriptural and priestly traditions of Buddhism, Islam, or Christianity, the Mongols remained animists, praying to the spirits around them. They worshipped the eternal blue sky, the golden light of the sun, and the myriad spiritual forces of nature. The Mongols divided the natural world into two parts, the earth and the sky. Just as the human soul was contained not in the stationary parts of the body, but in the moving essences of blood, breath, and aroma, so too the soul of the earth was contained in its moving water. The rivers flowed through the earth like the blood through the body, and three of those rivers began here on this mountain. As the tallest mountain, Burhan Haldun, literally God Mountain, was the Khan of the area. And it was the earthly place closest to the eternal blue sky. And as the source of three rivers, Burhan Haldun was also the sacred heart of the Mongol world. The secret history relates that Temujin, grateful for having escaped death at the hands of the Merkid, first offered a prayer of thanks to the mountain that protected him, and to the sun that rode across the sky. He made special thanks to the captured old woman, who had saved the others by hearing like a weasel. To thank the spirits around him, as was Mongol practice, he sprinkled milk into the air and on the ground. Unwinding his belt from his robe, he hung it around his neck. The sash, or belt, traditionally worn only by men, was the center of a Mongol man's identity. For Temujin to remove his sash in this way was to remove his strength and to appear powerless before the gods around him. He then removed his hat, put his hand on his breast, and dropped down onto the ground 9 times to kowtow before the sun and before the sacred mountain. For the steppe tribes, political worldly power was inseparable from supernatural power, since both sprang from the same source, the eternal blue sky. In order to find success and to triumph over others, one must first be granted supernatural power from the spirit world. For his spirit banner to lead to victory and power, it had to first be infused with supernatural power. Temujin's 3 days of prayer while hiding on Burhan Haldun marked the beginning of a long and intimate spiritual relationship he would maintain with this mountain and the special protection he believed it provided. This mountain would be the source of his strength. Rather than merely giving him the power, Burhan Haldun seems to first test him with a difficult choice. Each of the three rivers that flowed out from the mountain offered him an alternate choice of action. He could return to the southeast, downstream to the Harlan River, where he had been living on the steppe. But no matter how many animals or wives he managed to accumulate as a herder, he would always risk losing them in another raid to the Merkid, the Taichud, or whoever else came along. The Onon River, along which he himself had been born, flowed to the northeast and offered another option. Because it meandered through more wooded and isolated land than the Harlan River, the Onon offered more shelter, but it lacked pastures for the animals. Living there would require the group to scrape by, as in his childhood, while fishing, trapping birds, and hunting rats and other small mammals. Life on the Onon would be safe, but without prosperity or honor. The third option was to follow the Tule River, which flowed toward the southwest, to seek the help of Ong Khan, to whom he had given the sable coat. At that time, Temujin had declined the offer to make him a subordinate leader under Ong Khan's authority. Now, only a year later, with the life he had chosen instead shattered by the Merkid raiders, Temujin still seemed reluctant to plunge into the internecine struggle of Khan against Khan. But there seemed no other way to get back his bride. Though he had sought to create a quiet life, apart from the constant turmoil of steppe warfare, the Merkid raid had taught him that such a life was simply not to be had. If he did not want to live the life of an impoverished outcast, always at the mercy of whatever raiders chose to swoop down on his encampment, he would now have to fight for his place in the hierarchy of steppe warriors. He would have to join in the harsh game of constant warfare he had thus far avoided. Aside from all the issues of politics, hierarchy, and spiritual power, Temujin showed how desperately he missed Borta, the one person in a short and tragedy-laden life who brought him happiness. Despite the emotional reserve that Mongol men were expected to show in public, particularly in the presence of other men, Temujin made a strong emotional affirmation of his love for Borta and of his pain without her. He lamented that not only had the attackers left his bed empty, but they had cut open his chest, broken his heart. Temujin chose to fight. He would find his wife, or he would die trying. After those 3 difficult days of pondering, praying, and planning on the mountain, Temujin followed the Tule River down to search for the camp of Ong Khan and seek his help. But he would do so not as a lonely outcast. He would do so as the rightful son who had already brought the powerful Ong Khan a prized sable coat and allegiance. When Temujin found Ong Khan and explained that he wanted to launch a raid on the Merkid, the old Khan immediately agreed to help. Had he not wanted to fight, Ong Khan could easily have deferred, and instead offered Temujin another wife from the women in his own encampment. The old Khan, however, had a lingering feud of his own with the Merkid, and Temujin's request offered him a pretext to attack and loot them once again. Ong Khan also sent Temujin to seek additional support from a rising young Mongol ally of the Khan's, one who had been proving himself an adept warrior and had attracted a sizable following. This man was none other than Temujin's sworn anda, Jamukha, of the Jadaran clan. Jamukha readily agreed to the summons from his Khan to help his young blood brother fight against the Merkid. Together, they would form the steppe ideal of a good army with Aung Khan leading the right, or west wing, and Jamukha leading the left, or east wing. The armies of Aung Khan and Jamukha gathered with Temujin's small band at the source of the Onan River near Burhan Haldun, from whence they would cross the mountains and drop down on the steppes into Merkid territory along the Seling River in the direction of Lake Baikal. Temujin had survived many difficult scrapes in his short life, without engaging in an actual raid. In this raid, he would prove himself up to the task, though the raid was really more of a rout. Some Merkid, on a night hunt in the mountains, saw the attacking army and rushed word back to alarm their people, arriving only a little ahead of the invading horsemen. The Merkid began fleeing for safety downstream, and panic overtook the whole string of encampments. As the raiders began their looting of the Merkid's gurs, Temujin is said to have raced from camp to camp among those left behind, crying out Borta's name. But Borta, who had been given as a wife to an older Merkid warrior, was loaded into a cart and sent away from the battle. She did not know who was attacking her new home, and did not want to be kidnapped again. She had no reason to suspect that the attack was launched to rescue her. The secret history describes in detail how suddenly, from amid the confusion and turmoil around her, Borta heard a voice crying out her name and recognized it as Temujin's. Jumping from the cart, she raced through the darkness toward the voice. Temujin twisted frantically in his saddle as he peered out at the night and shouted her name again and again. He became so distraught that he did not know her as she ran toward him, and when she grabbed the reins of his horse and snatched them from his hand, he almost attacked her before he recognized her, whereupon they threw themselves upon each other in an emotional embrace. Although the other two women were not rescued, Temujin had won his wife back again, and nothing else mattered now. He had inflicted upon the Merkid the same pain that they had caused him, and he was ready to return home. The secret history reports that he said to the attacking troops, "We have made their breasts to become empty, and we have made their beds to become empty, and we have made an end of the men and their descendants, and we have ravished those who remained. The Merkid people being so dispersed, let us withdraw ourselves." After the decisive victory over the Merkid and Borta's emotional reunion with Temujin, the newly reunited couple, still well under 20 years of age, might have hoped to live joyously together, at least for a while. But as happens in life, the solution to one problem can create another. Temujin found that Borta was pregnant. Rather than describing the tremendous happiness for the couple at being together again, the secret history falls silent about Borta and their life together for the duration of her pregnancy. This silence would reverberate through Mongol politics for the next century in a long debate over who had fathered Borta's eldest child. Borta gave birth to her first son in 1179, and Temujin named the boy Joch, which means visitor or guest. Many scholars accept that as evidence that Temujin did not believe the child was his own, but he may just as easily have given that name to signify that they were all the guests of Jamukha's band at the time of the baby's birth. The relationship that the secret history dwells on in detail at this time is Temujin's renewed allegiance with Jamukha. After the dramatic rescue of Borta, Temujin decided to join his small camp with Jamukha's larger group of followers. Temujin led his small band to Jamukha's encampment in the large fertile area known as the Horhonak Valley, located between Temujin's ancestral Onon River and the Herlin River. For the third time in their young lives, Temujin and Jamukha made their vows of sworn brotherhood. This time, they swore their friendship as two grown men in a public ceremony, with their followers as witnesses. Standing before a tree at the edge of a cliff, they exchanged golden sashes and strong horses, By exchanging clothing, each shared his body smell, and therefore the essence of his soul with the other. The sash, in particular, embodied the symbol of their manhood. They swore a public oath to let us love one another and make two lives into one, never to forsake each other. Celebrating their pledges with a feast, including much drinking, Temujin and Jamukha publicly symbolized their brotherhood by sleeping apart from the others under a single blanket, just as true brothers grow up sharing a single blanket. By moving his small group away from the protection of the mountains and out onto the steppe with Jamukha, Temujin was trading the life of a hunter for that of a herder. Although he loved hunting throughout his life, Temujin's family never again depended exclusively on it for their subsistence, enjoying a higher standard of living with a more consistent supply of meat and dairy products as part of Jamukha's group. Temujin had much to learn from Jamukha's people about the herding way of life, in which well-established customs governed all aspects of the yearly routine, and rightly specialized knowledge of the animals revolved around the management of cows, yaks, horses, goats, sheep, and camels, which the Mongols called the five snouts, since they counted yaks and cows together. Every animal provided crucial subsistence materials in addition to food, with the horse being the aristocrat of them, not being used for work other than riding. Of course, given the constant feuding among the clans, in joining with Jamukha, Temujin was also electing to assume the life of a steppe warrior, a role at which he would come to excel. Their Anda relationship allowed Temujin a special status with the larger hierarchy, so that he did not join as a regular follower. And for a year and a half, so the secret history says, Temujin seemed content to follow Jamukha's lead and learn from him. But perhaps for the young man who had killed his older half-brother, rather than submit to his dominance, any such arrangement would inevitably become irritating. And in this case, old steppe customs of caste hierarchy also came into play. Under the kinship hierarchy, each lineage was known as a bone. The closest lineages, those with whom no intermarriage was allowed, were known as white bones. More distant kin with whom intermarriage was allowed were the black-boned lineages. Since they were all interrelated, each lineage claimed descent from someone of importance. But the strength of the claim depended on their ability to enforce it. Temujin and Jamukha were distant cousins, but of different bones, because they traced their ancestry back to a single woman, but to two different husbands. Jamukha descended from her first husband, who was a stepherder. Temujin descended from the forest hunter known in their oral history as Bodonchar the Fool, who had kidnapped the woman after killing her husband. According to this descent, Jamukha could claim that, because he descended from the firstborn son and had been fathered by a stepman, his lineage was higher. Such stories are used in steppe society to emphasize bonds when needed, but they may also provide the pretext for animosity, and in the relationship between Temujin and Jamukha, the story of their kinship would play both ways. Kinship was not so much the determinant of relationships as it was a general idiom through which people made, negotiated, and enforced their social claims. As long as Temujin was a part of Jamukha's band, then Jamukha's family ranked as a white bone, and Temujin was a part of the distant black-boned kin. Only if he established his own band with himself and his lineage at the center could he be considered white-boned. As the months passed with Temujin following Jamukha's leadership, the account in the secret history suggests that Jamukha began to treat Temujin less like an Anda and more like a younger brother, also emphasizing that Jamukha's clan descended from the eldest son of their common ancestor. As already evidenced in his family relations, Temujin was not one to accept being treated as an inferior for long, and soon enough, this situation proved unacceptable to him. The secret history recounts that in the middle of May in the year 1181, Jamaka called for the breaking of winter camp and headed toward more distant summer pastures. Jamaka and Temujin rode together, as usual, at the front of the long train of their followers and animals. But that day, Jamaka decided that he was no longer willing to share his leadership position with Temujin. Perhaps Jamaka realized that Temujin had proved very popular with the other members of the band. Or perhaps Jamaka had simply grown tired of his presence. Jamaka told Temujin that he himself should take the horses and camp closer to the mountains, while Temujin should take the less prestigious sheep and goats and set up another camp closer to the river. The white-boned Jamaka seemed to be asserting his authority as the horse herder, and was treating Temujin as the black-boned shepherd boy. According to the secret history, when Temujin received the order, he dropped back where his own family and animals were traveling in the rear of the train and consulted with Oilun. He seemed confused and unsure how to respond. Upon overhearing Temujin describe the situation to his mother, however, Borta interrupted and insisted angrily that her husband break with Jamaka, and that they and whoever wished to follow them set out on their own. Later in the day, when Jamaka stopped to pitch camp and rest for the night, Temujin and his small entourage fled in secret and continued moving throughout the night in order to put as much distance as possible between them and Jamaka in case he decided to pursue them. Either by plan or spontaneous choice, many of Jamaka's followers fled with Temujin, taking, of course, their animals. Despite this fission of the band, Jamaka did not pursue them. The rift between the two young men on that early summer night in 1181 evolved into 2 decades of warfare, as Temujin and Jamaka both rose in stature as leading Mongol warriors and hardened into the bitterest of enemies. After his split with Jamaka at the age of 19, Temujin seems to have determined to become a warrior leader of his own, to attract his own followers and build a base of power, eventually aiming to become a Khan, the leader and unifier of the unruly Mongol tribe. In that pursuit, his chief rival would be Jamaka, and their feud would gradually engulf all of the Mongols in a civil war. The two rivals spent the next quarter of a century stealing animals and women from each other, raiding and killing each other's followers, and struggling to see which one would eventually rule all the Mongols. Over the coming years, Jamaka and Temujin each acquired a following of families and clans among the Mongol people in a constantly shifting set of ephemeral alliances and pragmatic loyalties. Yet, neither proved able to unite all the lineages into a single tribe, like the more powerful Karayid, Tatars, and Naiman. According to Mongol oral history, they had once before been united under a single Khan. But in recent generations, no one had been able to reunite them. In the summer of 1189, the year of the cock, and 8 years after his break from Jamaka, 27-year-old Temujin decided to make a play for the title of Khan, the chief of the Mongols, with the hope that once he claimed the title, he would attract more of Jamaka's followers and make the claim into a self-fulfilling prophecy. If not, the claim might at least provoke a final struggle between the two and lead to a more definitive solution to the rival claims. He summoned his followers to a step beside the blue lake at the foot of the heart-shaped mountain, where they held the traditional council called a Hurultay. Families, lineages, and clans voted merely by showing up. Their presence served as an official endorsement of Temujin as Khan. Not appearing counted as voting against him. Merely attracting a quorum constituted a victory. On such an occasion, A list would usually be made and memorized as a form of election verification, but no tally survives, possibly indicating a modest turnout. A large number of the steppe lineages, perhaps even a majority, still supported Jamukha. Temujin's tribe, which now consisted of his family, a loyal coterie of friends and scattered families, was small by comparison to the other steppe tribes, and he was still a vassal to Ong Khan. To show that his new office was not meant as a challenge to Ong Khan, Temujin sent an envoy to the Karayid leader to reassert his loyalty and to ask his blessing. Temujin's envoy explained carefully that all he sought was to unite the scattered Mongol clans under the leadership of Ong Khan and his Karayid tribe. Ong Khan agreed and seemed to worry little about the unification of the Mongols, so long as they remained loyal. Ong Khan kept the subservient Mongols divided. By encouraging the ambitions of both young men, Ong Khan was playing the two leaders against each other in order to keep both weak and under his control as the Khan of the Karayid. Having received the support he deemed sufficient to function as the Khan of a minor group, Temujin began a radical process of erecting a novel power structure within his tribe, calling on the lessons of his youth for guidance. A chief's complex of gurs that served as his tribal center or his chiefly court was called an ord, or horde. In most steppe tribes, the Khan's ord consisted of his relatives and served as a sort of aristocracy over the tribe, managing it and leading it. Temujin, however, assigned some dozen responsibilities to various followers according to the ability and loyalty of the individual, without regard to kinship. He gave the highest positions as his personal assistants to his first two followers, Borch and Jelm, who had shown persistent loyalty to him for more than a decade. Temujin Khan exercised a decisive ability to assess a man's talents and assign him to precisely the right task based on his ability rather than his genealogy. The first appointments went to trusted men to serve as cooks, a job that consisted largely of slaughtering animals, butchering meat, and moving large cauldrons for boiling it, but which Temujin also considered his first line of defense, because of a fear he had developed of being poisoned, as his father had been. Other followers became archers, and several received responsibility for guarding the herds, which often had to be taken great distances from the main camp. He appointed his large and strong brother Kassar as one of the warriors charged to protect the camp, and he placed his half-brother Belgate in charge of the large reserve of geldings that always stayed close to the main camp for use as mounts. He also created an elite bodyguard of 150 warriors, 70 day guards and 80 night guards to surround his camp at all hours. Under Temujin, the administration of the nascent Mongol tribe became an extension of Temujin's own household. Despite Temujin's success in becoming recognized as a Khan and in establishing his administrative court, Jamukha still commanded his own following, steadfastly refusing to acknowledge Temujin as the Khan of all the Mongol clans. For Jamukha and the aristocratic white-boned lineages, Temujin was no more than an insolent upstart, whom the black-boned people idolized, but who needed to be taught a lesson and put back in his place. In 1190, only 1 year following Temujin's election, Jamukha used the killing of one of his kinsmen by one of Temujin's followers during a cattle raid as an excuse to summon all of his followers to battle. Each side rallied an army, probably numbering no more than several hundred on each side, but estimates of size are only conjectures at this point in the story. In the ensuing battle, Jamukha's forces routed Temujin's followers across the steppe. To prevent their regrouping against him, Jamukha then perpetrated one of the cruelest shows of revenge ever recorded on the steppe. First, he cut off the head of one of the captured leaders and tied it to the tail of his horse.